Each year, when I was growing up, my brothers and I had to endure what always seemed to me to be a history lesson and quiz: the decorating of the tree. The annual ritual began well enough. My dad would put on the record player a record of Handel's Messiah. Specifically, he'd play the Hallelujah Chorus. Now, for those who may not know, a record player is a device from the before times when we used to have music on large vinyl CDs. And it's weird to think that the time's going to come when I'll have to explain CDs as well. Spotify made real. Anyway, each year, the decorating of the Christmas tree would begin with the playing of the Hallelujah Chorus. Now, my dad had a tremendous ear for music and a really deep love. But I'm sorry to say, the guy couldn't carry a tune in a bucket if it was stapled to his forehead. My brothers and I, on the other hand, were all musicians, and we had all sung the Hallelujah Chorus in our high school choir. And so, Dad would put the record on, and we would all sing the tenor part, or whatever part we could remember, of the fortissimo version. An aside, my brothers and I were all in the choir, and by serendipity, we all were given the same choir folder, number 42. And so when I graduated, our music director, who had had to endure all three Wickstrom boys, retired the folder. And I've honestly never known whether it was to honor us or to express relief. I don't know, and I don't dare ask. Anyway, digression. The annual Wickstrom decorating of the tree began enjoyably enough, but then it moved into that history lesson quiz. As each ornament was taken from the box in which it had been stored, my mom would exclaim, "Oh, remember this one?" And I suppose the quiz was really rhetorical, because she never waited for an answer. She would just launch into a recitation of that ornament's provenance. "This is the one that was made by Pat, my oldest brother, that we made for Pat, my oldest brother, when he was born. And Paul, my next older brother, sent this one to us when he lived in Portland. And oh, look, Eric, here's that stick you painted in kindergarten." Story told, each would be lovingly placed on the tree, making sure that there were some ornaments on the back so it wouldn't feel lonely. Now, to say that my brothers and I endured this tradition is to confess to what I'm sure would be my parents' stunned disbelief, that her kids weren't really all that into that ritual every year. But my mom, as all parents sometimes pretend to be when their adolescent kids are feigning disinterest, she would appear oblivious and would tell the same stories year after year. The pièce de résistance of our ornament collection was the angel that topped our tree, Angie. My mom had made Angie the first year that she and my dad lived together, when they didn't have the money to buy proper decorations. Mom took an empty paper towel roll and pasted paper straws all around it. That was Angie's robe. She then cut wings from a pie tin, painted delicately a ping pong ball for her head, gold embroidery thread made her hair, and she bent some wire to make a halo. Thus birthed, Angie would sit on the top of each year's tree. Now, over the years, her halo got bent into what Mom called a rakish and jaunty position, and the hem of Angie's robe got a little singed from being too close to the lights one year, which Mom said with delight proved that while Angie was an angel, she wasn't all good. Actually, the way she put it was, "She's an angel, but she knows how to have fun." Angie was always the last thing put on the tree, always Christmas Eve, and it was given to my brothers and me to place her on top in a fair rotating pattern that was carefully recorded on the back of the box she was housed in to avoid the otherwise inevitable squabbling that would result. When her kids had kids of their own, and we would all gather together, it was the honor of crowning the tree with Angie that fell to the youngest child in the room. Now, somehow, after my parents' death, Angie came to live at the Wickstrom Brand James house. And so did many of those ornaments I knew so well from growing up. And so did the tradition of telling the stories of each one as it came out of its box. My kids, unlike my brothers and me, are rapt and rapturous in their attention. Yet I feel really sure that they too, one day, are going to tell their children as they engage the decorating of the tree. Now, a couple of weeks ago, during our multi-bread communion service, Leah invited everyone to turn and talk with someone they didn't know all that well about some traditional food that was part of your growing up or part of your family today. And the cacophony that followed demonstrated just how many of us have such traditions. And I'm sure if we were to ask questions about holiday traditions in general today, the same thing would result. Now, this morning, I'm encouraging us to embrace what might be to some mere tradition, repeated rituals that have lost any meaning, those things that are perhaps overly familiar, so common as to be common and not to shine any longer. There are, of course, sometimes downsides to simply carrying on traditions. Sometimes the tradition does separate itself from any original meaning it might have had, and it turns into just something we do by rote. There's a fairly well-known story. A man and his husband were spending their first Christmas together. And as they were preparing dinner, the man cut the end off the Christmas ham before putting it into the baking dish and then into the oven. The man's husband looked at this and asked, "Why did you just do that?" Well, the man was stymied by this line of inquiry. He'd never really thought about it. It was just something he did. And then he realized that it was something he did because he'd seen his mom do it year after year when he was growing up. So he told his husband this, and then the husband said, "Okay, well, why did your mom do this?" It's kind of weird, you know. Well, the man didn't know that, nor did he know why his mom had done it. It had always seemed like the thing you do. So he called his mom and asked why each year she'd cut off the end of the Christmas ham before putting it in the deep baking dish and then into the oven. And she paused for a moment, just like he had. And then, chuckling, she said, "I'd never really thought about it before. It's just what I'd seen my mom doing." So the man's mom called her mom and asked if she remembered always cutting off the end of the Christmas ham before putting it in a baking dish and then into the oven. And if she did she remember why she did that? "I don't know why you'd ask," the man's mom's mom said. "It was just that my baking dish was too small." When I thought about telling that story, I was pretty sure that a number of you would have heard it before. And by the way, some of your heads nodded and the smiles of recognition that I saw, I knew I was right. I told it anyway because, as any good storyteller knows, you can't hear a good story often enough. That's true, isn't it? I mean, those stories that we hear, that maybe we ourselves tell, seem to get deeper and more meaningful with each successive telling, even if it's only because of the memories of each previous telling. The familiarity of them makes us comfortable and allows us to hear things in them we probably didn't hear the first time because we were too busy concentrating on the story itself rather than on whatever depth it had. Spiritual practices can be like this. For some, the Catholic ritual of saying the rosary every day is a profound practice because after years of reciting the same words over and over again, they were freed from having to think about the words and could enter more deeply into the experience of them. I've read about and known people who say that although the words don't change, the way they hear them, the way they experience them does change as they themselves change. My dad, for a while, considered himself a Catholic. He eventually became a Presbyterian by way of the Baptist, but that's another story. He told me that during World War II, he found himself at Mass in a small stone church with a mud floor on an island in the Pacific. He knew the Mass by heart by then, so he no longer had to worry about when to stand and when to kneel and when to do all the different things that you do. And although he didn't know what all the Latin meant, he knew the words well enough that he no longer had to think about them. And he said they had actually begun by this point to become a little stultifying, because he knew them too well. And then he said he suddenly had a profound realization. At that exact moment, in simple churches such as he was in, and in grand and ornate cathedrals, people around the world were doing exactly the same thing he was. And that people had been doing this exact same thing for hundreds of years. And he was struck by a feeling of connectedness, such as he'd never known. And this, he told me, more than once, only happened because of how rote, how familiar this ritual had begun, become. Rituals, repeated practices, traditions that are intimately familiar because we do them year after year, can help to ground us to the people around us, to the people we've known and loved, and to ourselves. They can help us to center something that's so important in such tumultuous times that threaten to blow us this way and that way. Rudyard Kipling's famous poem, If, begins with the words, "If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and putting the blame on you." Well, touchstones such as singing the Hallelujah Chorus and hearing once again how those glass ornaments were made by Mr. Pat when he worked in the glass factory from the waste materials, or by making the latkes exactly the way your mother and grandmother and grandmother did, or maybe even cutting the end off your Christmas ham just to remember Christmas's past. They can offer us a sense of rootedness that comes only because we've heard the story and done the thing countless times before. This kind of groundedness can help us to achieve Kipling's charge. Two more things before I'm done. First, I want to acknowledge that there are times when family traditions are painful rather than profound. The first Christmas after my mother died was more than bittersweet. As we brought out each ornament, I found myself choking up, unable to tell the long-told tales. Angie didn't bring memories of my childhood or of my parents. It just reinforced the loss and the hole that had formed in my life. parents who are estranged from their children, friends whose friends have abandoned them, partners going through divorce, people who've had their lives upended by job loss, folks whose own mortality has become all too present. For all such people, the familiar can become painful. Blue Christmas isn't just a Miles Davis tune. It's an all too real reality for a great many people, as is Blue Hanukkah, Blue Thanksgiving, and Blue Birthday. A few weeks back, I encouraged us all to remember that not everyone enters into this holiday season, or really any season for that matter, in the same way. And that we should try to keep open a compassionate space for each of us to be where we are, even if where we are is different than where everyone else seems to be. The other thing I want to acknowledge is that I realize not everyone has such traditions. Life may have been too turbulent growing up, or is now. And there's nothing that we come back to over and over again. Perhaps we've even convinced ourselves that traditions are mere repetition for the sake of repetition. Remember, though, even the quest for the ever new and unusual can become of itself a tradition and a purveyor of mere novelty. To each of us and to all of us, I encourage us to dive deep into or to develop, if you need to, traditions that can ground us. Traditions that can center us when all about us are losing their heads. And that can help us grow more deeply into who we are. The RE committee and family ministry team have been encouraging people to buy or make their own chalice and to get into the habit of lighting it each night or at least on Wednesday nights, a practice that can ground us in ourselves, in our day-to-day life, and connect us to this wider community. I encourage this too. I encourage any practice that we can find that holds us into our lives, because there's so much in the world that strives to pull us from ourselves. Whether it's a Christmas tree, a Hanukkah candle, a Thanksgiving dish, wearing the happy birthday hat, or simply greeting each day by saying good morning day, there are things we can do day after day after day. And I would say that we should. Let's take together a moment of silence.